I want to start out with a riddle tonight, and I want you to answer the riddle. The riddle is, when is an age not an age, or when is a given age not an age? One could probably answer that riddle by saying, a given age is not an age when a woman gives her age. We're not interested in that age tonight. When is a date not a date? We're interested tonight in radioactive systems of dating, particularly carbon-14 tonight. And I don't think we'll get to U-238. We have long been exposed in Western civilization to dates that make it appear that the Earth is very ancient. These dates have been based upon presuppositions of uniformitarian geology and biological evolution. When I was a child and we went to a museum, we had the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, and we had Brontosaurus and all the various types of dinosaurs, which incidentally were taken, most of them, from over here in Dinosaur National Park, since Carnegie financed that expedition. And there would be dates like 30 million years old, 50 million, 60 million years old. Now those dates were based upon presuppositions of biological evolution and uniformitarian geology. They argue in a circle. But we have lived into the nuclear age, and now in the nuclear age, there are scientists who are utilizing years or dates or ages that they claim to be based upon the science of radioactive dating. Now this has to be very confusing to your children when they're taught that the Earth is relatively young in church, and then they get confronted with stuff, why on the carbon-14 system this thing dated out here, or on the U-235, or potassium-argon dates these rocks as 4 million years old. And it looks like now that instead of just the presuppositions of biological evolution and uniformitarian geology, that now they have really a science and they can really date these rocks. Well, this is what we want to talk about tonight: carbon-14 and other radio system or radioactive systems of dating. So carbon-14 normally is written this way, and other radioactive systems of dating. And in order to appreciate what we're going to say about C14 and maybe U-238 and potassium argon, we're going to have to go through the system. Okay? So the first thing we want to talk about are the systems, let's just say the systems. There are basically two. So if we make two columns like this, we're going to talk about the first one. The first one is called carbon-14, which is normally symbolized by 14C. The second one is U-238, or uranium-238, which would be written 238U. Okay? Now, potassium-argon fits also in this system. We'll talk about C14 and U-238, at least just to give you enough information about how these systems determine time, okay? Now, the C14 is sort of an atomic clock for dating once-living substances. Sort of an atomic clock for dating once-living substances. In other words, we put a qualification on it now. Bones, skins. Now, these would be bones, of course, that have not crystallized or petrified. These would have to be bones that were still hadn't degenerated into petrification. Skins, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, could be dated from the carbon-14 method because they were once living and they hadn't completely degenerated yet. Plants, and so on. But the key to the carbon-14 thing is that it had to be a living substance. Where U-238 and potassium argon is sort of an atomic clock for certain rocks. Particularly volcanic substances. Okay. Now, advocates of this view, advocates of C-14, will often post dates 40,000 years old. I'm going to show you that a good lab that uses C-14 won't do that. So these people who follow C-14 or sometimes use C-14 sometimes post dates 40,000 to 60,000 years old. Okay? We're over here in the U-238. These will sometimes talk about rocks being millions of years old. Okay? Millions of years old. Okay? Now what I'd like to do is go through, those are the two basic systems. You'll read more about potassium argon now than you will read about U-238. What I want to do is go through C-14 tonight. And I want to make sure you understand it. So if I'm not communicating, I want you to be sure to ask questions, okay? So under point two, we're going to talk about the basis of C-14 or 14C dating. Okay. Remember what we said, the qualification on C-14 is that it had to be a substance that was once living. It could be a plant, it could be a tree, it could be a human bone, an animal bone, it could be a skin, it could be hair, anything of that nature that was once living. Okay? Now, under point one, under the basis of C-14 dating, we need to know that there are at least two carbons. There are at least two, and maybe we should say basic, carbons in all living things. There are at least two basic carbons in all living things. The first of these is a 12C or C12. C12 is a stable, non-radioactive isotope or carbon. The second carbon that is in all living things, whether it's a plant, whether it's an animal, whether it's Homo sapien, is 14C or C14. Now, C14 is very unstable. It is an unstable radioactive isotope. Okay? Which means that it is going to degenerate. It is going to send off radioactive waves. Now, this in researching this was exciting because carbon, I found that carbon is one of the most important atoms of all living systems. The three basic foodstuffs, protein, fats, and carbohydrates, all contain carbons. They contain both these carbons. There is carbon in the genetic code, that is, in the DNA molecules, your program of the life cell in human beings. There are carbons transmitted in procreation. We're born with a certain amount of carbon in us. Okay? Now, C14 degenerates. And the computing of a bone, or the age of a bone, or any living substance, is the basis of the ratio between the C14 left against the total carbon content in the bone. In other words, this is the becomes the basis, C14 becomes the basis of measuring the age of the substance. Now what I want to do is go through the points, or through the way that measurement is taken. Okay? First of all, we says there are two basic carbons in all living things, C12, C14. C14, unstable, radioactive. Okay? So, point two. C14 C14 changes into nitrogen by giving off a beta ray, which of course is its atomic ray. And that beta ray can be measured, by a Geiger counter. Technically by a Geiger-Müller counter. Only Müller never gets credit. Geiger gets all the credit. Now, the more counts per minute that you have coming off of a bone or a living substance, a skin or something like that, means the more C14 there is left in the substance. In other words, if you have a beep, 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 beep on the Geiger counter and you measure the beta rays coming off the living substance with your Geiger counter, and you can compute the time, and you can determine how much C14 is left in the substance. If you have beep, 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 then you know there is more than if you had beep, beep, beep. Okay? Okay. Now, point three under this system of dating. C14 follows in its degeneration. It follows a fascinating one-half life principle. It follows a fascinating one-half life principle, as do most of the radioactive elements that we know about. In other words, one-half life of 14C equals 5,760 plus or minus 50 years. Okay? Okay, meaning it takes 5,760 years for the first half of the amount of C14 that's in a living substance to degenerate into nitrogen. Okay? So if you went 5,760 years, one half of the life that was in something would be gone. Or one half of the C14, I'm sorry, that was in something would be gone. Then it would take another 5,760 years for half of the next life to be gone, which would be how much of the original life left? Fourth, right. Then it would take another 5,760 years for one half of the rest of the life that was in the living, the rest of the C14 that was in the living substance to be gone, which would be how much of the original? 1/8, right. Okay, you're with me. Okay. Okay. Point four. Hence, a scientist can date the once living substance. Remember, C14 is only for living substances or substances that were once alive. He can date the once living substance if, let's see how much you're thinking. What would be the first thing he would have to know? How much was in it, right? How much was in it when it died?
he would have to know, he would have to have a fixed point of reference to determine how much life had left. To do that, he had to know how much was in there when it died. Okay? So he would have to know, A, first of all, the exact amount, if he knew the exact amount of C14 or 14C in the living substance when it died. Why would it have to be when it died? Why couldn't it be when it was alive? Well, it hadn't already started decay. That's pretty good. In other words, while it's alive, there's a potentiality that it might change. So he had to know how much C14 was in there when it died, or when the animal or the person involved or the tree involved was alive. Okay? Secondly, he can measure the rate in which the If he can measure the rate in which the C14 leaves or degenerates. Okay, now if he has the right tools, he knows how much was in there when the living substance dies, and then he has the right tools that he can measure the degeneration of the C14 or the disappearance of it, and this he would do on the 1/2 life scale. See? He can do that. The third thing, then, is he would have to determine how much is still present. How much is still present. Okay, now let's try to illustrate this. Before the advent of what are these new ovens we have now? Man, I guess. Can you hard boil an egg in those? You can't hard boil an egg in there. Oh, I didn't think they were any good. I knew. No wonder I didn't get one. Okay. So maybe you still have an egg timer around. Okay. And the old-fashioned egg timer, this is an egg timer, men, so. Okay. An old-fashioned egg timer, there were three critical factors in this old-fashioned egg timer. Here's the sand coming down, and it's piling up in here. Okay. Okay. There are three critical factors in this egg timer. Now, we know a priori that it's supposed to take 3 minutes, and that's about all we know about an egg timer, for all the sand. You dump it all up for the boys and girls that haven't done this. You know, nobody eats soft-boiled eggs anymore, except me. When you want a soft boiled egg, you take this egg timer and you would just turn it over. All the sand would be in the bottom, and you just turn it over. And we all know that it takes how long for the sand to get through there? Let's see if we're together. 3 minutes. Now that's for a 3 minute soft boiled egg. 3 minute soft boiled eggs are too hard. You got to get them a minute and 55 seconds. And then you have to have the water. You have to watch that water till it just starts bubbling, see? Different at this altitude. Right. Tom, we would have a connoisseur of soft-boiled eggs. He must have been raised in Las Vegas. Las Vegas, they can make eggs. Any way you ask. Any place in Las Vegas. They got the greatest egg makers in the world in Las Vegas. Cookers, fryers, whatever. All right. Now, we do, we go to the 5 and 10 and buy one of these, and we say it takes 3 minutes for the sand to get through there, and we just take it for granted. That's what it is. But somebody had to figure that out. Now, what were the three critical factors? What would be the first one? Sin. How much sin? Okay, the first important thing is the total amount of sin. Okay? What's the next critical factor? The rate, yeah, the diameter of this orifice. It's going to let the sand fall into this other part of the egg timer. If that diameter is too big, it goes through too fast. So that orifice determines, there's another thing that determines, and if you live in a humid climate, you blow it because it gets humidity in there and then the sand won't run through. But assuming you're in a good climate like Denver, then the rate of the movement of the sand. And the thing that determines the rate of the movement of the sand is the texture of the sand and that orifice through which it passes. Okay? The third thing that tells you where you are is the amount of sand that has moved through. And there's just no way of knowing on an egg timer until the whole 3 minutes, till it's all passed through. And then you know it's 3 minutes. You want to stop somewhere in between. Why? You have to look at a watch. Okay. Now, C14 is very similar. Gee, I wish I would have left room out there. Here is C14. We're going to let this bone illustrate the egg timer. Looks like Phyto's fibia. Here's Phyto's fibia. When Phyto died, he died all over. But there is a form of radioactive energy in Phyto's system. It is in his bones. It is in his skin. I don't know about hair. Skin, bones, yes. And that is C14. That is one system. That is for sure that's in there. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been alive because C14 is a vital carbon or a vital element of our living. Okay, so C14 is in there, but it is degenerating into nitrogen, or part of it is degenerating into nitrogen. It is giving off beta rays. Okay? So, one thing that we would have to know would be the total C14 at death. The second thing that we would have to know is the rate, that is the change, the rate of change to beta rays or the giving off of the beta rays. The third thing that we would have to know is the amount that went through the orifice, so to speak, the amount that has dissipated. Dissipation. Is that spelled right? Probably not. Okay? Okay. Point five. We are going through the points. Did I give them to you by numbers? Yeah, I think I did. Okay. Can we determine how much carbon elements, particularly C14, is in the average human being, animal, plant, and so on that die? That's the next issue. Can this number one factor be determined? The answer is relatively yes. So point five is to illustrate that. Okay? Plants? Yes. Yes. Then it's a radioactive system of beta. No. Where do I give this point and you'll see? Okay? Plants, animals, humans. plants, animal, humans, each have the same ratio. Plants, animals, and humans each have the same ratio of C14 to C12 as does the air. We're now moving to where the C12 and C14 basically initially comes from. In other words, it's not just perpetuated in the human race by DNA. Just because mom and pop had X amount of ratio between C14 and C12 in their living organism, and I am their child, does not ensure that I will have the same ratio as mom and pop. See? In DNA, I get the basic start. But I've got to have more carbon elements put into my system. See? Okay. And one of the sources for C14 is, I guess, the major source besides DNA, besides genetics, is the air. Okay? So what we're saying under point 5 is that plants, animals, humans, each have the same ratio of C14 to C12 as does the air. And the concentration in the air is relatively, now please understand that, relatively constant if, I'm going to qualify this now, if uniformitarian processes remain constant. When I say uniformitarian processes, I mean in the atmosphere. In the atmosphere. Let's qualify it. Okay? Okay. Well, we're going to see how that... Let me show you how that happens. I'm going to show you that in just a minute. I want to explain this little statement here. There are uniformitarian processes or uniform processes in our environment that are quite consistent. We get, for instance, Denver now has caught up since we had an inch and a half or 2 inch or 3 inch rainfall to where we are normally at this time of the year in moisture content, in the receiving of moistures. That's because we have we can figure out how many inches of moisture. One of the first questions I asked when I went to Hawaii, talk to somebody knowledgeable. How many inches of moisture does this island get? How many inches of moisture you get here? How many inches of moisture that is in the mountains? How much on the beach, etc.? We have relatively uniform processes in our atmosphere. But the atmosphere can be affected. We're learning more about this by storms on the sun, sunspots, which we think now are storms, and they affect our atmosphere. But over the years, scientists have been able to measure this, and there is not that much fluctuation. Now, the basic presupposition of carbon-14 system and practically every system of radioactive dating is that those uniform processes have always gone on in the atmosphere. Hence, any living substance from the past has gone through the same type of environment that we have today. Now, that is a basic presupposition of that system. Okay? Now, let me try to show you the sort of the carbon-14 cycle. In other words, where does the C14 come from? Or from where comes the 14? So, I'm going to pose some questions. Question number one. From whence do we get the carbon? From whence the C14? That is, in, from whence, how does it get from one place into the living substance? Well, we already said that the DNA genetic process is part of it. But there is sort of a carbon cycle that runs like this. First you have C14 in the air, or it gets into the air, it gets into the atmosphere, it actually gets there from outer space. I'm going to show you that in a minute. But it moves from the air into a plant. And from the plant, this happens, of course, by photosynthesis. It moves from the